Welcome to The Social Science of War, a podcast that brings together scholars and practitioners to better understand land warfare, the Army, and national security strategy. My name is Kyle Atwell. I'm an Army officer currently instructing international affairs at the Social Sciences Department at West Point. And in today's episode, I speak with two experts on the challenge posed by cyber threats against the United States, the specific characteristics of the cyber domain that make it a uniquely challenging problem set, and how the Army and broader national security community is organizing to address this challenge. Our first guest is Colonel Candace Frost. Candace is currently the Joint Intelligence Operations Cell Commander at United States Cyber Command, where she works day-to-day in assessing cyber threats against the United States and its allies and partners. Previously, in her role as a military intelligence officer, she also helped establish the Army Cyber Branch. Our second guest is Dr. Maggie Smith. Maggie has been an Army cyber officer since the branch was established in 2014 and is currently an assistant professor in the Department of Social Sciences at West Point and a researcher at the Army Cyber Institute. She also founded the Competition in Cyberspace Project at the Modern War Institute. The Social Science of War podcast is brought to you by the Department of Social Sciences at West Point. Our goal is to provide professional development resources for land warfare scholars and practitioners. We hope you enjoy this conversation with Candace and Maggie. Colonel Candace Frost, Dr. Maggie Smith, welcome to Season 1, Episode 2 of the Social Science of War podcast.
This is great, Kyle. Thanks.
Thanks so much for having me, Kyle.
Today, we're going to talk about the role of cyber operations within multi-domain operations with a particular focus on implications for the Army and land warfare. I would like to get to how the Army is specifically organizing to address cyber threats and to understand the role of cyber should the Army end up in great power conflict or large-scale combat operations. But before doing so, let's start by characterizing the challenge posed by cyber threats in the current international environment. Colonel Frost, in your role as the commander of the Joint Intelligence Operations Cell at CyberCom, you have a front-row seat in understanding the cyber threats posed to the United States. What is the scope and character of threats the U.S. is currently facing and the kind of challenges that you focus on in your day-to-day work?
Yeah, thanks for asking, Cal. And I think both Maggie and I have been incredibly fortunate to not only understand kind of the scope of the problem, but also to work together towards really diving into solutions. When we look at the information space and kind of how the military addresses this domain, our job really at, and where I'm at the United States Cyber Command, two-thirds of our job is really focused on defense. How do we make sure that networks that are using critical information in the Department of Defense and the things, how we communicate back and forth, and so much information that is run through all these different levels of networks that we have, how do they remain safe and secure? And so that's a huge portion of what we do at Cyber Command. The other third of the kind of scope of what we're looking at is also on not only defensive, but offensive operations. And that's focused external towards nation state, primarily actors that are out there trying to get into our systems and to cause harm to either the Department of Defense's information networks or broader to the national security kind of sphere that we have in totality. That is the focus of really what we do. Myself, I am focused on understanding who those foreign actors are. As a military intelligence officer, I really look at where the threats are coming into this, specifically those nation states. China, of course, is our biggest area that we focus on in this domain and where we're looking at the largest number of threats. But my kind of moniker is China first, Russia always, that another great intel officer told me years ago. And it really is, it scopes down what we're looking at in the cyber domain. I'd be remiss, though, to neglect the work that Iran and North Korea have done towards the United States, specifically targeting the national security space.
Yeah, I'm going to take it in slightly a different direction by saying that I think it's such a challenging domain because those threats are constantly evolving much faster than they do in the physical space. So when we think about our traditional threats and traditional military threats, we have two big oceans on either side of us as a nation. That type of division and that type of geographic boundaries or the type of proximity that you can get is not the same in cyberspace. Cyberspace is pervasive. It's this kind of ethereal notion that exists where information passes and where we connect with each other and how globalization has really been able to take place. and shape our modern economy, our modern world, our modern geopolitics. And when you think about what Colonel Frost does from her perspective as an intel officer, like that is a massive task that really focuses her on anything that's coming at the United States. So it's a real crazy domain to think about threats emanating in and through cyberspace, because they can literally come from anywhere. Nation states are the priority of U.S. Cyber Command, but there's a lot of third party and proxy actors that also have a stake in cyberspace that pose a threat to us as well.
And to add to that, I think, Maggie, that's a really great point where we look at kind of the doctrinal definition, right? The Army is very good. We love to kind of narrow things down in our doctrine to scope what we're focused on and looking at. When we look at our doctrine in Cyber Command, we're really looking at persistent engagement. And so that is just constantly almost being on consistent high alert, always looking across the entire span or kind of sphere of unfortunate influence that other nations have used to try to match or succeed our level of competency where we have in this domain.
You know, it's interesting that the cyber attacks that come to mind for me as a non-cyber person, things I see in the news are, you know, threats against elections, the Colonial Pipeline attack, which was a big kind of infrastructure attack against the United States, or cyber attacks in large-scale combat operations, or even attacking, you know, potentially nuclear facilities of other countries. But protecting government networks, which you said, I think is about two-thirds of what we do, doesn't seem like it really grabs headlines. It's not quite as sexy, but it sounds like it does require, as you said, persistent engagement. Does that stress our systems? Does that stress our cyber warfare infrastructure where you're essentially always having to be turned on?
I think like anything in life, you have to understand risk. And with the lessons that are taught in the military, we are really very good at understanding and balancing, hey, where are your priorities? Of course, you can't defend everything all the time. And so when we look at the entire sphere, what is most critical? You mentioned one of them. Obviously, it's, you know, our nuclear weapons. That's incredibly important. So there's a high precedence and priority placed on those things that are incredibly valuable. We've, in the nations as a, in totality, we've really listed out what are the critical infrastructure areas that we've got to keep an eye on and remain focused. Another area you just mentioned is election security, and that's a huge part of what we do in cybersecurity, but we don't do it alone. We work with the Department of Homeland Security, specifically the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency. That's a little bit of a mouthful, better known as CISA. We work hand in glove with them, and then the Federal Bureau of Investigations, the FBI. So it's a real... At the federal level, we have got to work very closely with the example of elections, but all elections are local. So that meant that at the midterms that just passed, we had to not only work with at the federal level up here in the National Capital Region, those members that run a lot of the programs, but then there was a tremendous amount of outreach all the way down to like lower level community election officials and kind of making sure that the up and down that we went from either, you know, county, state, and all the way up to the federal level, we were working together to make sure that cybersecurity was front of mind during the elections and to prevent mis and disinformation getting out there. It's impossible to cover everything, but when you know what's most important, that's where the focus goes. And you can really see we were incredibly successful in the 2022 midterms.
So where does the Army fit into this mix of interagency collaboration with the military as far as addressing cyber threats? Do we cover specific threats, or do we just essentially integrate our talented people with, you know, joint and interagency task forces?
The good news is we kind of do both. So I am at a joint command, and I've got tremendous, whether it's the Cyber National Mission Force led by an Army officer, Cyber Command in totality led by General Nakasone, also an Army officer. But I've got great partners to include many people up and down from Air Force, Navy. We've got the Marines and the Coast Guard and both the National Security Agency and the Defense Intelligence Agency. So it's really an entire kit bag of the Department of Defense at U.S. Cyber Command.
One of the things I find fascinating is when you look back in the history of Cyber Command, it was founded in 2010 or stood up in 2010. And it originally was a sub-unified command under Strategic Command. And this gets to the point that it was a three-star command. And when you think about where it was placed, it had the connotation that cyber weapons or cyber capabilities were on level with a weapon of mass destruction, like a nuclear weapon, because it fell under the command of Strategic Command. And so that's a really interesting place for Cyber Command to start. And with a new legislation in 2018, it got elevated to a geographic combatant command. So now it is a four-star command. That is the same time when what Colonel Frost referred to as persistent engagement came about as our doctrine. So that was a real shift in terms of how we thought about our role in cyberspace. And we moved from being a very responsive or reactive and very hesitant to use cyber capabilities against our adversaries into a much more proactive understanding that the domain requires us to be very persistent about trying to initiate and achieve kind of strategic initiative over our adversaries in the space. And that requires a real heavy timing and tempo and a lot of work from all of the people that are within the cyber workforce. So if you look at Cyber Command now, the way that it's structured, you have every service has a three-star command underneath Cyber Command. And so the Army Cyber Command is head by Lieutenant General Barrett, and that's a three-star command located down at Fort Gordon. And within that, we have structures that support the defensive and offensive side. And we have a brigade that feeds into the offensive side that's headed up under the Cyber National Mission Force.
I want to tap back onto something that Maggie started with respect to what General Barrett does with her command down at Fort Gordon and the focus. And I think that's what makes this world so unique is not only does Cyber Command in totality look at the entire world, similar to other non-land domain commands like Transportation Command and Strategic Command, as mentioned. But when we divided it into services, that the Army, what their focus area is really central, the bulk of the work that they do is on Central Command, some on Southern Command, but primarily on Central Command. And I think what's so important about that is that's how the Army really earned its stripes in this domain, because this is what the Army does, right? We have an offensive frame of mind. We understand defense very well, but we also know, hey, what are those high payoff targets? Where are those areas that we should focus the bulk of the effort on? And when we look at, in totality, what is done in this space, and a tremendous amount of it is incredibly classified, but the things that we do understand and the lessons that we share and the things that are placed out for the entire world to understand is that we really do a great job in making sure our partners and those nations and allies that we have are defended very well, and that we're able to help those nations make sure that their networks remain free from other foreign actors that are trying to do bad things.
Yeah, added to that, I think what's really fascinating is to see how the lessons learned in counterterrorism and a lot of the CT fight done in Afghanistan and Iraq really translate into the mindset that that persistent engagement really looks at maintaining in cyberspace. Because you are looking at a threat that can come from anywhere. It's a networked type environment, and that type of agility that is required to respond to a CT threat is very similar to the agility that is required in the cyber forces to be able to respond to a new and emerging threat in and through cyberspace.
And I think that's the most exciting part, Kyle, about cybersecurity in totality, and kind of what a big part of kind of what lights the flame for me is that so much of what we learned in the Army, when we look at even creating doctrine for counterinsurgency and moving forward and understanding networks and terrorist activities, it is so transferable, not an exact fit. So I don't want to say the metaphor is completely aligned, but there's a large nexus if you understand that type of warfare and the way you fight that as what we do in cybersecurity. I think a lot of people, unfortunately, are intimidated. They really think you have to have a background in data science, data analytics, computer science, coding. But if you dive into, especially those listeners that are social scientists listening to this, Cybersecurity is a great place to lean into to really see, you know, what's important to a nation. What are the things that they're protecting? Where are the areas that they're trying to strike us in our national security kind of ecosystem and sphere?
So I'd like to get back to how the Army organizes for cyber in a little bit. But first, I'd like to go through a few more characteristics of the threat posed by cyber. The first one that you brought up, Maggie, is kind of persistent presence and that cyber attacks can come from anywhere at any time, which makes it a always switched on type of threat. But another one that you bring up in some of your research and writing is that it's a mix of state and non-state actors that pose threats. And you mentioned this in the beginning. You wrote an article about a particular attack, Colonial Pipeline, in May 2021. And in there, you argue that the attack reveals characteristics, including this point that potential cyber actors are not just states, but they include non-state actors. Can you give a quick rundown of what the Colonial Pipeline attack was for people who might not be familiar with it, and also what it tells us about these non-state actors and the role they might play?
Yeah, there's two main points I want to make about Colonial Pipeline. One is that low-hanging fruit are the ripe targets in cyberspace for non-state actors and nation-state actors. And then secondly, that motivations in this space differ, and that's what makes it a very complex problem for an army or, you know, a military type focus, because you're dealing with motivations that aren't your traditional nation-state type, I want to acquire territory type motivation. So Colonial Pipeline is the largest pipeline that runs up the Eastern Seaboard. And there's a growing trend of this convergence between information technology, like our business systems, the communication systems we use in businesses, the billing systems, those are all considered information technologies, and the operations technologies. And those are our big SCADA systems, which are like our industrial control systems. So the systems that monitor the pipeline, that run the pipeline, control the flow, those types of things are considered our operations technology. And in the past, much of that has been controlled manually, where the pipeline, or you can think of a rail line, where the switch was used to be physically moved or changed over by a person. So a lot of that has been automated, which then necessitates its connection to an internet or the internet or a network or some sort, so that it can be controlled remotely. And so the convergence of information technology or the business and billing and that operations technology is what we saw in Colonial Pipeline. So a ransomware attack was perpetrated by a non-state actor against the Colonial Pipeline's business infrastructure. And what happened is it locked up those IT systems and prevented the company from being able to accurately bill its customers, which then prompted the company to shut off its operations technology and stop the flow of oil on the East Coast, right?
So it didn't shut down because the actual infrastructure that runs the pipeline was attacked. It's because actually the administrative functions of the company to manage the business side of operations was attacked.
Yeah. And so this is, like, I think a really interesting attack from the perspective of whose motivations matter and why. And so Colonial wanted to shut it down because it couldn't bill. And so it would lose money. Right. And the crazy part is that then we saw this outcry on the East Coast. You know, there was runs on gas pumps and, you know, a lot of public panic that this non-state actor who conducted the ransomware attack had not intended. It drew a lot of spotlight onto this attack, and that group ended up being pretty ostracized by the ransomware kind of as a service outfits. But it's a very interesting mix of, like, the motivation from that group was purely monetary. They wanted to steal some money. And from Colonial Pipeline, its response was monetary as well, because it shut down its technology so that it could prevent, you know, losing money by not being able to bill customers. So it's a really interesting mix and raises a lot of questions for how do we then respond to it.
So many people thought actually they struck the pipeline itself, but really it wasn't. There's a downstream effect. And what this showed us was the fragility of the system in totality. That was incredibly impactful, and it woke a lot of people up to not only the fragility of our system, but also what is critical infrastructure and how close we are in certain areas if something does, you know, get hit or struck. other nations were watching this. And I think that's also of importance. It's not just the impact it had on those people out east here that were trying to fill up their gas car. It was also an impact of what other nation states were viewing and the lessons they were learning from this. And I think the government itself took that under huge amounts of consideration. We have seen over the past couple of years, just an almost boom in understanding of cybersecurity and the focused areas that we have to have as a nation on growing this as a part of our national security. It's been a really dynamic change. And this event was one in a series, but it was probably the most impactful.
With this ransomware attack, do we know that this group was not supported by a state, even if they had monetary aims? And I guess that goes to a bigger question. It seems like states, if they wanted to be clever and they wanted to hurt the United States without being attributed to it, could work through non-state proxies and essentially support their ability to conduct these attacks while essentially keeping their hands clean.
Yeah,
is that a component of this challenge?
Yeah, I think, and I know Maggie will hit a home run with this, but I always say, you know, attribution is the hardest thing in life in cybersecurity. And that's the biggest bumper sticker. You know, attribution is hard.
Yeah, it's really hard. And I mean, the other part is that different states have different thresholds by which they decide to view hostile or malicious cyber actors within their borders. So there are some states where we consider it safe harbor, right? Where these were Russian actors and they were not considered criminals within the state of Russia. Russia has a very open kind of understanding amongst its hacker crew. I do a lot of research right now on Killnet, which is kind of this DDoS or distributed denial of service outfit that is pro-Russian, and they are mostly Russian actors, it seems. There's a deep understanding amongst that community that if you do something in this space and it doesn't have any impact on Russia, or you don't attack Russian networks, then you're good to go and you're okay to operate. And so a lot of what we see in this space is that there are certain countries that will provide safe harbor or turn a blind eye to this sort of criminal activity, especially when it hits something like the United States and has strategic impact that benefits that nation state, then they'll turn a blind eye to it. So that's where attribution gets really fuzzy, because does Russia know that these actors are operating within their borders? Probably, yeah. But like, is it state sanctioned? Well, I mean, we might be able to find some intelligence that would suggest that they have connections to the state. But at the same time, you know, they're still, as regular civilians, they're still able to conduct this criminal activity and not get prosecuted by Russia, because Russia's state turns a blind eye against it. So that's, I think, what's really fascinating about the conflict that's been going on in Ukraine and the cyber activities that have taken place around that, is there's been a lot of third-party groups that have gotten it, or, you know, kind of staked their claim in this space saying like, I'm pro-Ukraine or I'm pro-Russia, and have been conducting activities not at the bidding of a nation state, not at the bidding of Russia or Ukraine, but on behalf of those states and on behalf of those populations, and tried to make an impact and have an impact in those various states outside of the traditional actors in the conflict, which creates a very different type of operating environment that is much different than something that we see in a very geographically confined kind of conventional fight.
Those groups go on both sides, right? I think one of the things I heard recently, which is interesting, is that the group Anonymous, I think, has sided with Ukraine and therefore, I guess, ostensibly would be doing things that the Ukrainian government would like, but probably has almost no control over, if I understand it correctly.
Yeah, that's people and groups that are non-state will come out in support and they'll act on behalf of, you know, saying I'm going to do things in support of Ukraine or whatever. And the state does not have control over what those actions are. And that throws a wild card. And when you're thinking about it from like U.S. Cyber Command perspective, how do I deal with and how do I respond to non-traditional sources of activity that are like, what do we do about this? Because it's not like we have laws in the United States where you can't, you know, hack as a private citizen. And so so what does that mean? And what is it on the battlefield? Like, how do we actually handle these types of non-state actors that are working virtually, not located in the region of the conflict, but acting on behalf of one of the sides of the conflict?
as a very non-cyber oriented Army officer, you know, I'm a combat arms guy. At what point do I need to start thinking about this, you know, as a company commander, battalion commander, brigade commander? Are these things that our non-cyber Army units need to be thinking about proactively? Or is this kind of something where you focus on your day-to-day organizational tasks and there's a cyber task force or an Army cyber element out there that's doing this outside of or non-organic to your unit?
As an officer, I would say this isn't something you can just delegate over to your cyber protection teams or your teams that are defending the networks, kind of look at your signal officer and say, hey, man, you got it. It's a part and it's an understanding, just as great officers understand logistics, right? You don't just leave things to your logisticians, or the same thing with intel. We have specialties in the military where there are people that kind of go to the PhD level and have an understanding of these areas, like an intel officer. We spend our lives really diving down into what the threat is and understanding the nature of the enemy and the threat and how that's posed. But as an operator yourself and all other operators that are out there, you still have to understand who you're facing. And I think that's an important part of people who are listening, is really don't just kind of delegate this task to someone else. Start to lean into it. Have them explain the difference between, and Maggie mentioned it already, like a DDoS attack. What is ransomware? Ask those questions and have them explain it to you so that you reach a level of understanding of the difference and the things that you may face in the future. You don't always have to or need the PhD level understanding, but you've really got to grasp this because it is a part of the future of war.
One place that I think everybody in the military needs to be aware of is that we all have in some way, shape, or form an online presence. And if we have a soldier that has, you know, 70K followers on TikTok, like that's something I, as a company commander, I need to be aware of, because that can be a force for good, but it can also be a very big force for bad, right? Like depending on what that soldier is posting. And so I think from that level, if you look at it at kind of the way that we array troops and the way that we communicate with each other, understanding what it means for soldiers to leave their cell phones behind in garrison if they go to the field, because that, if even by virtue of like eliminating kind of that signal threat from the training environment, when those phones go dark in a specific space, that also sends a signal. And when they're there for 3 weeks at a time and they haven't moved, then that sends a signal of how long that training is going on and things like that. And so like the presence of signals and the absence of signals are both indicators of activity. And so when you think about your just tactical formations, we're all emitters and collectors of, you know, signals. And so just by virtue of driving down the road, I'm bouncing off of cell towers. So if somebody really wanted to, they could track my movement. And so being aware of that doesn't mean trying to eliminate that threat or that risk down to zero, but it means being aware of it so that you can create mitigating strategies to minimize the risk of exposure or minimize the risk of what the emissions that you're putting off just by virtue of being a, you know, a digitally connected person have on your greater forces and on the strategic kind of movements that are being had around the world.
Leaders do need to understand like what good cyber hygiene is. I know we take a tremendous amount of training in the military, right? And the mandatory training that you have in this area, sometimes it needs to be specialized into what you do. And leaders should understand, and we've already kind of, you spoke about, hey, there's a digital footprint. That's a huge part. You know, what are those settings that you have on your cell phone? Walk through that. Wouldn't that be great if everybody just pulled out their phone and in my heart of hearts deleted TikTok? That would bring me much joy. But also the other thing that they could do is, hey, what are your passwords like? What do you have on that's tracking you, to kind of go to what Maggie's saying, and then really practice good cyber hygiene. Leaders do that. We do safety briefings with our units and organizations about holiday weekends and not drinking too much, or, you know, doing things that are self-harming. Well, let's do the same thing with the computer that we have in our pocket that tracks us everywhere we go. I think that's the charge that I would have to leaders out there that could really help in totality our military forces.
You know, when we deployed to Afghanistan, most people were able to bring their cell phones with them to the outpost and bring them on patrols, and it wasn't a big deal. But what you made me realize, and what will be devastating for many soldiers, is if we end up in a large-scale combat operation, people might have to leave their cell phones behind.
At West Point here, someone made the comment that, cadets were using their cell phones in the classroom, and someone chimed in and said, why don't we just have them not be able to use cell phones during the day? I don't think that's the right answer either. We live in the 21st century. Technology is a part of our everyday life. It's really figuring out how we can best educate the cadets that are here, understanding that communication environment and the electronics that are used and kind of the modern way of existing. So it's not necessarily these knee-jerk reactions that a lot of people like to have of like, we need to ban them. All these types of digital electronics need to be banned. I think we need to really think through good ways of living with modern technology, because that's the realm that we're in. And you know, even if you ban something, there's going to be one soldier that's going to have the cell phone in their pocket.
And, you know, as the old grad on this podcast, I would say, I don't want to go back to my time on the plains where we were, you know, using slates and stones to chip things into rocks. All joking aside, really, we have to exist within the ecosystem in which we live. And I think it's important. Like, we need to be a part of, you know, we are representing the nation. So we should be a part of the culture of the nation in which we serve. There has to be an extra layer of understanding how to keep us secure, because we're holding the nation's security in our hands, and we're developing really an understanding of that next generation that's going to go forward and lead. I'm totally on board with you, Maggie. Like, the bans of anything typically don't turn out very well.
So we've talked about a couple characteristics of cyber threats: persistent presence. There's a multitude of state and non-state actors, and this kind of can lead to an attribution challenge. Another concept that you discussed, Maggie, in some of your research and publications is the offense-defense balance. Can you explain the basic social science theory here and then how it applies to cyber specifically?
Yeah, sure. So there's been a kind of an ongoing thought that cyberspace is really offense-focused, or that it's an offensive domain, meaning that offense has the advantage. And so this offense-defense balance is a concept, meaning which type of strategy is dominant in a specific space. So is it going on the offense, or is it conducting defense? And one of the things that I think we need to move away from is we continue to talk about it, and I'm guilty of this as well. We continue to talk about our formations as offense and defense, when in reality, I think we all need to be part of, we need to eliminate that bias between offense and defense and think about cyberspace as this holistic domain where any actions that we take in quote unquote offensive space really have a reflection back to what we are postured as in a defensive space. And all of our defensive measures and the things that we see on quote unquote defense really are going to help identify ways that we can have impact against our adversaries in the quote unquote offensive space. So we have this concept within US Cyber Command of our hunt forward operations. And there's been a couple of publications recently out about them in the media. But really, a team goes forward on the request of a partner nation, and they get to, you know, work with soldiers and the military from that nation and look at their networks and see what malicious activity is happening there. And that provides not only that host nation with some training and ability to mingle with U.S. cyber forces, but it also provides our soldiers, sailors and airmen and coasties and Marines an opportunity to work with the partner nation and see what's happening on their networks. And all of that activity is considered a defensive action, despite the fact that geographically it's forward deployed, and temporarily it's before something happens, right? We're looking at activity that's taking place outside of our own networks, but then we can apply the lessons that we learn from that activity and apply it to our own networks in a defensive posture to better secure our own systems. So what I would you know, advocate for, is that really thinking about this as an entire cycle, because the activities that we conduct on a daily basis have the ability to inform and improve our defensive posture, meaning our security posture, as well as to further inform what areas we might need to be looking at or what weaknesses or vulnerabilities we might be able to exploit in our adversaries. So there's much less distinction between it being an offensive or a defensive domain, or the bias between those two, and much more of a holistic domain where both are equally important and feed into each other.
And Maggie, the National Security Strategy that was just released really speaks to this as well. When we look at the importance of partnerships and partnerships with other nations, I think that's a big growth area that we have seen, not only with, you know, those five-eyed nations that are very close with us with respect to partnerships, but other nations that want us to have Hunt Forward teams come and assist them on their networks. Because at the end of the day, this is not restricted, as you know, the start of this podcast opened with Maggie saying, like, there aren't two big oceans that kind of protect a bit of the United States. Information flows back and forth very freely. You can firewall many different things, and some countries have greater firewalls than others.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, when I think about how you would need to train and select a Army cyber professional, I would think it would be based on technical skills. But partner warfare, which is essentially what you're talking about, working by, with, and through, or alongside others, is a whole different set of skills in the human domain. And with our security force assistance brigades, with our special forces units, there's a whole selection and training process to make sure you know how to interact with other human beings from other countries. So it's interesting that these are attributes that you're also kind of expecting of our cyber professionals as well, that I probably wouldn't have anticipated.
Yeah, so this is, like, you're speaking my love language here. I've been really focused on the commonalities and kind of the natural affinity for the unconventional warfare doctrine and irregular warfare as part of how we should really be thinking about cyberspace and the way we operate there. And so the security assistance forces, I think, are a real place where we can have some natural synergy between our Hunt Forward operations and the work that soft forces do. I think there's a lot of potential for growth there. And I think we're going to see a lot of synergy and a lot of partnership opportunities happen between soft and cyber forces as we move forward, because both are experiencing growth and both are going to be increasingly in demand, I think, as we move forward in strategic competition and finding ways that we can best posture our forces both globally when we think about the soft presence around the world, but then also virtually when we think about enabling those soft forces from a cyber capability.
Maggie, some of the social science literature has argued that cyber is an offensive domain, which you already kind of brought up. And that means as a tool, cyber attacks favor offensive action over trying to maintain a defensive posture. However, you have made the case that, in fact, offensive operations are very difficult in the cyber domain, probably a lot more difficult than, say, a non-cyber army leader would anticipate. Can you explain the challenge with cyber as an offensive tool?
Historically, you know, there's so much more information, I think, so much more data on the offensive attacks that have been successful, and there's much less good, rigorous, empirical work done on the defensive postures that have been successful, because we don't know about a defensive failure until there's actually a successful attack. Maintaining and sustaining an offensive capability is very difficult because those are perishable and they're fragile, meaning that if I have access to a network that's one of my adversary's secure networks, I could lose that access in a matter of seconds if they do a patch on their systems or if they find that vulnerability and they patch it or they fix it. And so the ability to find a vulnerability in an adversary network or device and to sustain it, to maintain persistent presence so that you can use it at the time that you want to, is really, really, really hard. And so I think that's become increasingly a part of the dynamic in cyberspace, is that those offensive capabilities are perishable, they're fragile, and they are not certain or guaranteed at any one point in time to work, which makes them very difficult to integrate into multi-domain operations when you're thinking about being a regular commander trying to integrate forces. If you don't know that you can rely on that cyber capability, then am I going to incorporate it in? Or do I know that it's going to be available to me in 6 months when the operation kicks off? So all of those things add layers of complexity to conducting offensive cyber operations.
Now, and that's a good point, I think, for non-cyber Army professionals to be aware of, that I only know because you've written about it and discussed it with me before, which is, you know, I would imagine that I would say, hey, go ahead and do a cyber attack on our adversary now, and then you would just whip up a cyber attack. But a point you've made is that these things can take weeks or months or years to actually develop, and then as you emphasize right now, it could all get thwarted by, you know, essentially a patch or something like that. So I think understanding the character that offensively it's actually quite difficult to plan a cyber attack is an interesting component.
And it's also, in the end, what is the outcome and what is the intended effect, right? That's another point. Does it have an impact if it shuts down the system for 3 hours and they patch it and fix it and they move along? Or does this, you know, degrade the entire network itself in one particular area or some kind of impact on a SCADA system? I think that is something that we have to look at from our perspective as well with respect to the people that, you know, are the highest level leaders in the United States that are asking for options. It's our job to kind of provide them which areas, and with the complexity as well, and the fact that you could lose access or it could get patched. I think there's a whole nother side of, you know, what's trying to predict, hey, what kind of impact this will have and what's the effect. That's another truly PhD level kind of understanding of this work that I'm always amazed when people who are cyber officers have the foresight and the ability to kind of think forward and understand the intended effects of what they're doing.
Luckily, the social sciences department has PhDs thinking about
this. I know, we're so lucky. We're so lucky.
I do have one more question, and I realize we're bumping up on time, so we don't need to spend too much time. But looking at the application of cyber in large-scale combat operations, a lot of what we've been talking about is essentially peacetime operations. But if we ended up in a major war, some of the scholarship that you cite, Maggie, argues that the link between cyber and conventional military operations is at most indirect. And you've also cited other research that, and this is a quote, cyber operations are a form of modern political warfare rather than decisive battles. Do cyber operations play a role in conventional military operations? Is this something that we should expect if we end up in a major war that our units will be engaging with on the battlefield?
The conflict in Ukraine has been a really interesting example of modern warfare where there are two conventional forces and then some asymmetric tactics being applied within there. And seeing, so I've been working with some colleagues here and at Columbia University to collect information on the cyber incidents that have occurred that are publicly available to surrounding that conflict in Ukraine. And what we've seen is that, you know, the conflict is really taking place outside of the borders of Ukraine and extended into the information space, while much of the conventional fight is remaining within these geographic borders. And I think what we're seeing is that cyber is such a unique domain because it's wholly dependent upon all of the other domains of warfare to exist. So you can't have cyberspace unless you have all of the other domains of warfare in existence. The perishability and the fragility of capabilities and accesses do not bode well for when we get in this kinetic on kinetic fight. And so when you see infrastructure being destroyed, that can also translate into access for cyber capabilities being destroyed at the same time. So when a power substation goes out, there could have been some access that an adversary maintains in that network that powers that. And so this conflict is going to help us, from a social science perspective, understand the role that cyberspace operations plays in modern warfare from the perspective of two modern armies going against each other in the kinetic space, and see how cyber relates to that and where cyber has been effective and where it has been ineffective. One thing that I think is really interesting is that a cyber attack can be very successful and actually get the intended effect or have the intended operational outcome that it's supposed to have, but its strategic impact may not succeed in the manner that it was intended. So the opening salvo for Russia was an attack against Viasat, and it did exactly what that attack was intended to do, but strategically it did not have the intended impact because an alternative mode of communication came in with Starlink and was able to provide and make up for that lost communication that happened with Viasat. So despite the fact that the attack was successful, there was a third party actor that was able to provide connectivity and make up for that lost connection, which is a really fascinating aspect of modern warfare that was totally unexpected from many ways from a passive observer standpoint. So, and I think that speaks to the complicated nature of modern conflict and really this concept of multi-domain operations and trying to incorporate all domains of warfare into a single conflict simultaneously is going to be a very complex problem.
So that's interesting. So in Ukraine, the Russians opened with a cyber attack against the Ukrainians, essentially communications platforms. And then a non-state actor, which is Starlink, it's just a private company, came in and backfilled it. Yeah, that's a really complex battlefield.
I'll say that also, it goes to the benefit of working together and preparedness. Ukraine and Russia really started to demonstrate this activity in cyberspace all the way back to 2014. So the fact that the United States and an ally of Ukraine was working with them for a long time in this area, and we had kind of even had a hunt forward team in Ukraine prior to the unfortunate decision of Russia to invade, we were able to assist them. So I think the lack of very large, which was expected, kind of cyber attacks, their defense was really assisted by so many different either nation states and then other private groups that assisted them that may have thwarted even larger scale attacks aside from Viasat that's out there. Also, a lot of goodwill, public goodwill from actors. I mean, tons of private companies really did make a huge impact. We don't know what the space will look like, though, if it is two larger nation states potentially towards us. It would be a very different landscape.
So we've talked about the characteristics of current cyber threats and cyber operations, how the U.S. government and the Army organizes and prepares for these. I guess my final question is, looking at the conversation in its whole, what are the biggest implications for Army professionals and scholars of land warfare that you would want to leave us with?
So I would say the largest area that I would leave you with is to continue to be a lifelong learner and really dive into this space. It's not as intimidating as a lot of people make it out to be. Obviously, instantly look up Dr. Maggie Smith's work and start to read a lot of the work that she has put out there. I think West Point does a phenomenal job with the publications that they have. There are plenty of either podcasts, YouTube, articles posted that can really kind of expand your understanding of this space in itself and how it ties into the future of war. So again, be a lifelong learner. Don't hold yourself back because you don't have a great technical knowledge or background in this, but start to understand it is going to be a part of the future that you will face as a leader in the Army.
It's really a multidisciplinary domain. It is not just about the technology because we can't tech our way out of a lot of problems. A lot of the vulnerabilities exist in kind of the human dimension that accesses and utilizes the technology. And so getting pretty intimate with your own understanding of technology and the things that you use in your daily life can really help you have a better understanding of the risks that will pose to you from the information dimension, as well as from cyberspace amongst your formations in the future as you move in through and out about your career. But it's really a fascinating multidisciplinary domain that, you know, has a lot of really interesting implications for international relations as we move forward, because increasingly we're seeing competition and conflict occur, that includes cyberspace as well as information capabilities.
Colonel Candace Frost, Maggie Smith, thank you for joining us on the Science of War podcast. I really appreciate you sharing your expertise.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thanks, Kyle. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Social Science of War podcast. This podcast was brought to you by the Department of Social Sciences at West Point. In our next episode, I discuss social mobility within the all-volunteer force and the current Army recruiting challenge with Dr. Kyle Greenberg and Command Sergeant Major Faith Alexander. After that, I discuss the role of NATO in a potential escalation of land warfare in Europe with Lieutenant Colonel Jordan Becker and Dr. Benedetta Berti, the head of policy planning at the Office of the Secretary General at NATO. If you enjoyed the episode, please consider subscribing, leave a positive rating and comment, and most importantly, please share the social science of war with other land warfare and Army professionals. One final note, what you heard in this episode does not represent the views of West Point or any agency of the U.S. government. Thank you again, and we will see you next time.